It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
So when again you did, Bruce, that came in Chicago.
Yeah, 1991 LPGA Chicago Sun-Times shootout at Oak Brook Golf Club by one over Chris Monahan.
Yeah, Bruce, you've probably driven right through the Oak Brook Country Club.
I have.
Being at the gates of Butler National. Yes.
That's right.
So, yeah, I mean, that tournament was, it was sort of funny because I was starting to, you know, pay attention to things a little bit. And it sort of irritated me, honestly, that we were playing outside Butler National when we went to this Oak Brook Country Club, and it was a little muni course.
Yeah, right.
And the clubhouse was maybe, you know, 800 square feet. And I was just a little irritated that, you know, look at this, right, you know, we're right outside the gates. Anyway, right. I also was staying with friends. I had some really good college friends that lived in the area. So I was staying with them. And, and the other thing was, I'm a big Green Bay Packers fan, and it was during the preseason. And my caddy, also from Wisconsin, was a big Green Bay Packers fan, and Packers were playing in Milwaukee, a preseason game on Saturday. And so, you know, I was playing the tournament. I have no idea what my scores were going into the last round, but I was near the lead, or maybe I was near the lead. But I wanted to go to the Packer game. So my caddy and a friend of mine and I, we drove up to Milwaukee, evening game. We went to this Packer game. I had a blast. We got back about midnight. I was like, it doesn't matter. I got a late tea time. And then my family, my siblings and my nieces and nephews all came on Sunday to watch me play, and because it was nearby. My mom and dad didn't come down from Sheboygan because my mom wasn't feeling well. And anyway, but my family was there. My brother came from Madison. My other sister came from Madison. My older sister was living in the area. So I had the whole crew there, the little nieces and nephews. It was really hot. They would come up onto the tee when I'd get to the next hole, and I'd give them some water. I'd like, come on, you guys, I'll give you some water. It's really hot out here. And I was just playing and having a good time and talking to my family and, you know, whatever. I was four shots down with four holes to go. I only know this in retrospect because, again, I wasn't looking at the leaderboard. Well, I birdied 15. I made a nice birdie on 16. I hit it in the junk on 17 and punched it out to about 3 feet and tapped it in for a birdie on 17. And I get to the 18th tee, and there's a big crowd around the tee, and one of my nieces squirms her way up to the front to get her glass of water. And she was about 6 years old. And she said to me, Auntie Martha, you're at minus 12 and the other's minus 13. That's only one different. And I was like, I am? Oh, okay, here's your water. Go away now. And I was like, oh, no. I don't want to know this. So it was a par five. And I go up to my caddy, who had been with me for a long time now. And I said, Tom, I'm one off the lead. And he said, just hit your shot out there. Don't worry about it. He gives me a two iron because it was a layup off the tee. He gives me my two iron. I hit my tee shot into the middle of the fairway. I hit my next shot down into the middle of the fairway. And the green was elevated green. The pin was on the left center of the green. The wind was going right to left. I was at 107 yards out, which was too short for my 9-iron, but too long for my pitching wedge. But I thought, you know, I don't know, I better be more safe than, you know, a little more careful here. So I pulled out my pitching wedge and aimed at the middle of the green. And I hit it. It flew past the hole, which I've never hit a pitching wedge that far, past the hole to the right. It backed up left into the hole for an eagle. And so I ended up birdie, 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 eagle.
Yeah.
And Chris Monahan came in and lipped out her birdie putt and for me to win the tournament. Yeah. So, yeah, it was quite crazy.
Oh, what a finish. Have you ever had a finish like that before?
Me? No.
Yeah.
No. Or since? No.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. You may recall, but just a few years before this, and I remember this because I lived pretty nearby. At the time, I lived in Elmhurst, which was just a few minutes away from Butler and Oak Brook. And they had big storms come through. Bruce, remember this. Big storms come through. And I've got video of all this where Butler National was literally underwater. A day before they're ready to start the tournament. And
wow.
They ended up playing the 1987 Western Open, 9 holes at Butler National, 9 holes on the golf course that you won on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So don't feel too bad. You did play the championship course where they played the Western Open back in 1987. That's a vivid memory for me because we had torrential rains.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Well, it was a nice golf course. It was sort of a fun little course to play, and every hole was kind of different. But it was sort of funny because a lot of the top players were saying things, especially even after my first win, the Stableford, and then this win, they were like, well, that wasn't a real golf course. And with the planners, Pat Bradley, not the best person really won. She barely made it into the second round. And, so there was a lot of undercurrent that I won these tournaments, but, they didn't really count.
So, Martha, it wasn't too long after this tournament that you lost a pretty important person in your life.
Yeah. The reason my mom and dad weren't at that tournament in 91 was because my mom wasn't feeling well. Turns out she had cancer. And they found that about a month after that tournament win. And she, had some, she was tired. She had a pain in her side. And, there was some funny number on a blood result or something. And turned out she had lymphoma of the spleen. And they said it was treatable and, 95% of these people that have this are, recovered with chemo, but she lasted just 2.5 months and, and it was, just a shock. I mean, total shock, she'd been healthy her whole life. She'd never had any major illnesses at all. And all of a sudden, she was a dynamo, and all of a sudden she was gone, and whew, that was tough. The next year, I was still, still sort of battling with the thought of her passing and, the stress of that and all. And I end up having my own stress-related illness. I was at the U.S. Open at Oakmont in 92, and I had seen Manuel just before I went to the tournament, and I had this pain in my jaw, and I kept, rubbing my jaw, and he was saying to me, "Are you okay?" I'm like, "Yeah, I just have this pain in my jaw." And then I went off to the tournament and got more and more sick feeling. It felt like I had a terrible cold. And the morning of the first round, I got up and I sort of stumbled into the wall as I was on my way to the bathroom, and I was brushing my teeth and water was coming out of my mouth as I was rinsing my mouth out. I was like, something's not right here. I went to the first aid tent and they took me to the hospital, and I ended up in the hospital with Ramsay-Hunt syndrome, viral infection that was in my ear. And destroyed my balance nerve in my ear and paralyzed half of my face. And so that was the end of my season in 92. It took me a long time, a year, to recover from it. But yeah, it was, my whole half of my face was paralyzed. And I was in the hospital for about 4 days. They said, when we can see you walk around the hallways here without aid, we'll let you leave the hospital. So I was like, okay, here we go.
There's some incentive.
You know,
yeah.
Hanging on to the IV stand as I'm, you know, trudging down the hallway. So I ended up going back to Sheboygan, and my dad was there, and, you know, went through the recovery, most of the recovery there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the balance nerve loss was really awful. And, you know, I have to learn how to walk without stumbling and how to swing a golf club again without falling over. And, it was quite the experience.
And Ramsey Hunt syndrome has been in the news the last week, hasn't it?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a 2 on a par 5 to win a 2-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you had to be there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I tell you about my albatross?
Yeah, I just saw Justin Bieber has been diagnosed with it. So, no, now people are hearing what it is, but it's a pretty uncommon affliction, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's really what it is shingles in your ear.
Oh, okay.
It's the shingles virus that goes into your ear and affects your
equilibrium.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah. So anybody who's had chicken pox or your shingles could actually go into your ear, and that, yeah, it's awful.
So that had to impact your game then for some period of time.
It took me about a full year, to really recover from it. So that happened in July of 92, and I started back on the tour in January of 93, but I wasn't really fully recovered. The doctors basically said to me, you will have to do all the things that you normally do in order for your good ear to relearn all the stuff. So there's really nothing in particular special to do. It's just do everything. And so when I started playing, when the wind, you know, your balance in your head, your balance nerves in your head, we don't appreciate them really because they do so much work. But if windy and your head's moving around like this, it can be really disorienting. And I would get nauseous on the golf course when it was windy because of all the, you know, the little movements that my body was still relearning to recognize.
Yeah.
And we played a tournament that had a suspension bridge. And when I walked over the suspension bridge during the practice round, and everybody's stepping differently and the bridge is moving in these crazy ways, I got to the other side. And again, I was nauseous the rest of the day. Mm. And, you know, not only were the players and caddies walking across the bridge, but the spectators were. So I decided when I was playing the tournament that I'd ask the marshals on either side to keep the bridge clear so that I would be the only one on the bridge. And it was about a 50-yard long bridge. It's pretty long. Mm. And I would then run across the bridge so that I wasn't standing there getting, you know, moved around a lot. And that was the only way I could get through the round without getting nauseated.
Yeah.
So But yeah, definitely took about a year for me to feel like I was not being affected by those things anymore.
Yeah. So, you know, you decide to get back in the winner's circle at some point. Let's just go win a major, huh?
Well, you know, when I was sick and I had a little bit of a relapse in October that year, one of the doctors said to me, you know, you're a professional golfer and you're going to need your balance. And you might consider that you'll never be able to play professional golf again. And I was like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Nah.
No. You just watch me. I'll show you. So, I mean, it really never entered my mind again that I wasn't going to play. So I kept playing. And again, my 93 season was, you know, not great because of, you know, still recovering. And I get into 94 and I'm still trying to get my confidence back and my game back. And I wasn't playing real well. We played in Chicago. Now the tournament that had, well, the Suntime Shootout had moved to Naperville. And I was there, and there was a guy there who was doing a little sports psychology presentation early in the week. And I, you know, I was always interested in learning all those things. So I went to it, and I kind of liked what he had to say. And so I went up to him afterwards, and I said, would you consider working with me individually? And he said, sure, let's start this week. And so he went out and watched me play. And, you know, he had some observations that he shared with me after my first round that he watched. Just things like when I would stand behind the ball and getting ready to hit a shot, I would take a practice swing, but I would never really finish the practice swing. I'd sort of, you know, fall out of it and then walk forward, whatever. He said, just finish your practice swing. Get to the finish, hold that for a second, and, you know, instead of falling back, you're sort of reinforcing this fallback thing. So I changed that, and I played better. I don't know if I made the cut or not, but I played better. I think I missed the cut. But I get to the next tournament, the Du Maurier in Ottawa, and so then I was talking to him, and he said, now, this is what I want you to do. The moment you step on the grounds at Ottawa Hunt Club, I want you to act like a champion. You walk like a champion. You think like a champion. You walk onto the first tee like a champion. He said, I want you just to act like a champion, no matter what's happening. And he said, and the other thing I want you to do is I want you to split your round into 3 6-hole segments. And he said, what do you think you can shoot per 6-hole segment? You know, 1 or 2 under? No, 3-hole segments, 6 3-hole segments. He said, what do you think? Can you think you can shoot 1 under for a 3-hole segment? I said, yeah, of course I can. And he said, okay, so 6 3-hole segments. Once you're done with those 3 holes, you put it aside. Now you're on your next 3-hole segment. And your goal is to shoot 1 under per 3-hole segment. So I go out the first round, and I shoot 6 under par.
Yeah.
And a tie course, the course record.
Course yeah. record, yeah, 6 under par, yeah.
Yeah, and so then I played, you know, after that, the next 2 rounds, I played okay. And I was, you know, around par somewhere. And I was near the lead. Was I tied for the lead going into the last day? I don't remember.
4-way tie for the lead after 54.
4-way tie for lead. Okay. And so was I in the last group? I don't remember that either. But I started out playing the last round, and I wasn't playing well. It was very windy, and, you know, I wasn't playing real well, and was a couple over par. But then we had a rain delay, and we went in and sat around for couple hours, I guess. And instead of sitting around with everybody in the main room watching the telecast or things like that, I just went into the back of the locker room and I just laid on the floor and did some stretching exercises and talked to a friend on the phone. And then we went back out to play. and I birdied that hole. I think I made, again, I'm bad with all the scores. I don't know where I stood exactly, but I birdied that hole, I think. I birdied the next hole. We're going off the green, and the marshal says to me, "We got a new leader." And I'm like, no, don't say anything. That's the last you're going to say to me. Oh, my gosh. And I don't want to know. And then we get to the next hole, and I make a long curling putt on this par three to take the lead. No, that was, I don't know, take the lead, whatever, one by one shot. So I had 16, 17, and 18 to play. And I lipped out a birdie putt on 16. I was playing with Michelle McGann, who had been the leader at that point. And 17, she hits it on the green, and I miss the green. Now I know where I stand, and I'm very nervous. And my arms feel like jelly, and I make a terrible swing, and I miss the green, the par three. And then I mishit my chip, so I bogey that hole. She pars it. So I'm now one shot ahead. And the 18th hole was a reachable par five for her, not even close reachable for me, except we were into a huge headwind. And I pop up a drive, and I smack my three wood down as far as I could go. Meanwhile, she smacks her drive, and she decides to go for the green in two, but hits it into a bunker about 40 yards short of the green. And then I hit my approach into the green. You know, again, we had this huge headwind, and I had to use about three clubs more than what I normally would hit. And I'm just standing there praying that the wind's going to keep blowing, because if it doesn't, I'm in the clubhouse.
No. Yeah.
And it did keep blowing, and I hit it close. But again, I was like, so into what I was doing, I didn't really know how it all stood. And she chunked her shot out of the bunker and then chipped. And then she putted and, you know, didn't make a birdie. And I'm standing on the side of the green waiting for her to finish. And I say to my caddy, I have about a 10-footer. I said, "Do I have to make this to win? I don't know." And he said, "No, you don't." I'm like, "Oh, good." Because I didn't make it. Again, I was so excited that I was going to win. And my arms were like jelly. And I missed the putt a little, you know, but I tapped it in. And yes, I won this major. And it was really unbelievable after all I'd gone through. And yeah, losing my mom. And whew, it was huge.
Sort of validation, yeah. As you mentioned, sort of the chatter after the Stableford win, and then you don't win on a real golf course. Well, now you've won a major, so get out of here. Yeah. Get out of here with all that stuff.
Yeah. It felt good. It felt really good. And it was, again, another funny manual moment. The next day, I happened to be in Milwaukee, and I was doing some interviews, and I was going up to Sheboygan, and I was like, I gotta stop and say hi to Manuel, and you know, we can celebrate that I won this major. And he was actually, when he gave lessons, there was nobody else in the world other than his student, and it didn't matter whether he was giving me a lesson and his wife walked up. He never gave her the time of day. Anyway, I walk up and he's giving Debbie Massey a lesson. And I'm standing off to the side because I know I can't interrupt him. And finally, Debbie sees me, who had actually had a good tournament. And she's like, "Martha, congratulations." And he turns and I walked up and he said, "Did you play the way you wanted to play?" And I said, "Yeah, I won."
Yeah.
Well, he said, "That's great." And then he turned and back he was to helping Debbie.
You were the only person to break par that last day, that blustery Sunday.
Wow. Yeah, I made some killer long putts too. That was the main thing.
Yeah.
They all help, don't they?
Yeah, they sure do.
You had one other close call, and that was in the 1996 HealthSouth inaugural at Walt Disney World. You were in a playoff with Kari Webb and Jane Geddes.
Yeah, you know, I was so sick that day. I had a really, really bad cold. And I don't remember, I really don't remember the rest of the tournament. I just remember that I was just trying to get through my last round. And I have no memory of how I played it, other than I can't wait to be done. Bruce, you know how what it's like when you're feeling terrible and you just like got to put the next foot in front of the last one and get
Let me out of here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I finished the round, my round, and I don't even know what I shot that day, but somebody said, you better stick around. You might be in a playoff. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
Really?
I feel horrible. And I had to wait several groups. I think I had to wait 45 minutes before everybody else was finished. And I was just sitting on my bag, just like completely slumped over, feeling so horrible. And then it turns out, yeah, I got to, you know, do the playoff. And I hit, you know, I had barely gone back to the range to warm up. I hit a drive on the first playoff hole into a bunker. And then from there, I hit it into a greenside bunker. And I didn't play the hole well. And I, you know, then I was out of the playoff. And was it Kari Webb's first win?
Yeah. She did win. I know that. Yeah.
I think it was her first win on the tour. So.
Now, Bruce, were you broadcasting some of the ladies' events back at this time?
That time would be I probably was still doing some. Although no, I don't think so. No, by then I was with ESPN. I'd left NBC by then.
Yeah.
But
we had so few women's tournaments that were broadcast anyway. So
yeah, that's true.
Well, you played during some interesting times, didn't you? I mean, you know, coming up, you probably saw sort of the tail end of Kathy Whitworth and Mickey Wright and Carol Mann and Sandra Haney, some of those, you know, the leading players, I guess, of the 60s. And then as you get into the 70s and Colgate starts coming up with some money for you guys and you get the Dinosaur going and purses go up a bit and another group of great players come on the scene, and then into the 80s where, you know, prize money probably was up 10 or 11 times from 1970 to 1980. And so times were a change and got a lot more tube time, as they say, on television. And you mentioned Nancy Lopez hitting the scene. I quoted this last time we talked to Sally Little, that Kathy Whitworth was our first guest, as a woman guest. And I remember her being quoted as saying that, Mickey Wright was our Ben Hogan, but yeah, Nancy Lopez was our Arnold Palmer.
That's right. Yeah. I feel so fortunate that I got to play with all of them. I mean, I knew Patty Berg. I only saw Mickey Wright play once. She had pretty much retired, but she played one tournament that I remember my first or second year, where she was actually in a playoff with Nancy Lopez, and I think it was the two of them. And I went out to watch her play because I always heard that her swing was the best swing there was, and I didn't know much what I was looking at, so I was like, yeah, it looks like a good swing. But I counted Marilyn Smith as a friend, and all the founders that were still playing, Marlene Hagee, and it was so cool. We would go in the lot after a round of golf, go in the locker room, and they would all be telling stories. And of course, Joanne Carner was there, and she was the best storyteller of them all. And you know, everybody would just sit around and tell stories. Sandra Palmer and all of the cronies. They were just all. It was the best time ever. And when they all left the tour, you know, those times of storytelling in the locker room ended. But yeah, I watched Annika Sorenstam come up and, you know, become the player that she is. And she really transformed the game in, you know, to the more modern game of the real working out. I was working out, but nobody knew it. And I wasn't, you know, showing anything by it, but, I had started working out long ago, but at any rate, you know, Beth Daniel, Betsy King, Patty Sheehan, all of those players, they, you know, they were all there, pounding us to oblivion.
Yeah.
What do you think of the modern game? I mean, you must be astounded at the level of talent nowadays with some of these young ladies coming on the tour.
You know, it is astounding. You know, the swings are simple and solid. They hit the ball a long way. Their short game. I have another story. So I had gotten off the tour, but I wanted to try to play in the U.S. Open in, I think it was Oakmont. I had to go back to Oakmont to get my time in there.
Yeah.
And so I went, and I knew Pia and Lynn, Pia Nielsen and Lynn Marriott, and I knew them. And I said, I want to come back and work with you a little bit to get ready for this Open. And I went to see them. I arrived at their course at 8 o'clock in the morning, and there was a Korean gal practicing putting on the green with her dad standing there. And we went off to do our thing, Pia and Lynn and I, and came back for lunch. And she was still on the putting green with her dad standing there, putting. Then we went off and played 9 holes and came back, and she was still on the green putting. Now, I don't know how many breaks she took during that 8 hours or whatever it was, but, you know, the discipline that they have has really changed. Again, transform the game to a new level. Their short games are phenomenal. The way they hit the ball, their demeanor, and I know people, spectators, don't necessarily like the players that aren't demonstrative, that aren't, you know, fiery and all of that, but it sure helps their game just staying a little more level. And it is pretty amazing to watch.
Did you play in that 1998 U.S. Open in your hometown?
I did. That was, it actually was one of the reasons I extended my career. I had been thinking about retiring, but with the Open being in my backyard, I was like, I have to play that. Yeah. I just have to play in that. And I almost didn't. I had to go qualify for it, because I hadn't been playing well that year. And I asked for an exemption thinking, you know, hometown person, I'm going to be a draw, and I'd won a major. And, they said, you got to earn it, you know. So I went to a qualifying site and hadn't been playing well, but had called my dad. And I was like, Dad, I'm going to be in the Open. He said, did you get in? And I said, well, not yet, but I'm going to be there. And I ended up going and qualifying. And it was, you know, winning tournaments and a major and all are certainly highlights. But I would say playing the U.S. Open in my hometown was one of the highlights of my career.
Yeah. You mentioned seeing that South Korean girl putting for hours and hours at Oakmont in 2010. Well, she can blame Sari Pak, because that's when Sari won that Open Championship at Black Bull Run 1998. I remember Jenny making that long putt, the amateur, to get in the playoff, right, on 18.
Yeah.
And then my wife and I went up there on the Monday, and while it was difficult, I mean, you know what it's like to have 20,000 people or what it was following two golfers in one group. It's not good watching, but it was quite an experience.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fabulous, fabulous event. And, you know, the funny thing, so here's a little backstory. Herb Kohler, my parents knew Herb Kohler from living in the area, and he was a member at Pine Hills Country Club. And he said, I'm going to build a golf course, and I'm going to bring a major championship to this golf course. And my mom and dad were like, maybe it should be an LPGA event. Of course, you know, everybody wants to have a PGA event. So my mom said, let's start a pro-am. Let's get a pro-am going and bring LPGA players in here to introduce Herb and, you know, the community to the LPGA so they know what a great product it is. So my mom started a pro-am at Pine Hills, and Herb, of course, was always played in it. Yeah. But I don't know if that made a difference, or it just happened to be that he could get a women's open, not the men's first. But yeah, it was a wonderful for me event to be a part of.
Yeah, it sounds like your mom should get some of the credit. You played senior golf a little bit, didn't you?
I did. This women's senior tour was just getting started when I got off the tour. After the 99 season. And I started coaching at Division III college, but I also wanted to keep playing a little bit. And the first senior event was in Green Bay. So, you know, it was sort of a logical thing for me to be in that tournament. So I went and played, and that was, I enjoyed it more than I thought I would, because I didn't know how I'd play. You know, I was not practicing like I had been. And, you know, when you don't play, you're like, how's it going to go? Yeah. But it was fun. It was fun being around my peers that I had, you know, then I don't see every day. So I did that through our second women's senior open just a few years ago. So I finally hung them up after just, you know, a couple of years ago, but I continued playing the senior events when I could, and won one of those tournaments.
Yeah, you won the 2006 Hy-Vee Classic.
Yeah, it was, it was sort of a product of the mind, really. I started going into it thinking, you know, my first senior event, I don't know how this is going to go. I just want to finish somewhere in the middle of the field and be respectable. Well, I finished right in the middle of the field. The next year, I was like, I didn't play very well. I'd like to be in top 10. I was 11th. And I was like, wait a minute. Okay. I don't want to be in top 10. I'd like to be third or better. I finished third. Oh. I was like, okay, what's going on here? So the next year, I was like, I don't want to be third. I want to win. Well, I missed a putt on the last hole that would have won the tournament. So I was like, I'm on to something here. The next time I played, I was like, all right, this time I'm going to win. I went into the room that had the trophy, and I held the trophy up, and I, you know, I did everything I could mentally to think about winning, or to picture myself winning, and knowing that I could, and that I had the ability, and, you know, I was leading the first day. Second day, I was close to the lead. I may be leading. And the last day, I was like, I really want to win this. And I started getting all worked up, you know, like, oh, you know, what if I don't win? And I sat myself down. And I was like, you know, how old are you anyway? If you don't win, what's going to change in your life? Nothing. You know? Yeah. And so if you're going to win, have fun. But what do I have to do? And I went back to manual stuff. You got to make the best swing you possibly can make right now. You can't get ahead of yourself saying, well, I got to make this many birdies, or I got to shoot this kind of score. I went through the process in my mind. What do I need to do here? I've got to make the best swing I can make right now. And then on the next one, I got to make the best swing I can make right now. And I ended up getting through it and winning. And it was a lot of fun. I wish I'd learned that stuff earlier.
You were the leading money winner in 2006 on the Legends Tour. How many millions of dollars did you win that year?
Well, take a few zeros off. I did win a lot of money for that. I mean, relatively a lot of money for that tournament. 100,000 or something. But yeah, no, I made just over $1 million in my career. So
yeah, you know, I still remember the buzz around the inaugural U.S. Senior Women's Open at Chicago Golf Club.
Yeah, it was so nice to finally have that event. You know, the senior women had been pushing for Senior Women's Open for many years. And as a matter of fact, in 2010, there was a men's senior, I know it's just called the Senior Open, but a men's senior open qualifier at the country club that I was a member at in Minneapolis. And I was going to also try to qualify for the 2010 U.S. Women's Open, just as, you know, something to do. Yeah. And so I entered the men's senior open qualifier at my country club, and thinking, you know, I know these greens, they're tricky. I've got plenty of distance from, if they play me from the tips, I don't care. You know, I've got plenty of distance. I know how to play this golf course. And again, you know, sort of a flashback to, not quite a flashback, but a little bit to my high school, the guys not wanting me there. You know, I was on the first tee and one guy that I was paired with said to me, "Why are you here?" And I said, "Because I'm going to try to qualify." "Well, why don't you do the women's?" I said, "We don't have one." "Oh," he said.
Never mind.
Yeah. So anyway, I didn't qualify, but I was respectable, and you know, and it was. But all of a sudden, the New York Times took that up and said, you know, that. Then I qualified for the Open at Oakmont, and I was the oldest player in the field, and so they were interviewing me, and they saw that I had done the other qualifier, and I was one of many people that were, you know, trying to bring attention to the fact that the women did not have a senior open. You know, the USGA at that point said, "Well, why would anybody want to watch the old women play? It would be like Jimmy Connors and Bjorn Borg slugging it out with wooden rackets." And I'm like, "Well, it's not really that." But anyway, it took a while for that first open, senior open. So yeah, for sure, I was going to play in that. And it was really well received. I think the USGA had their eyes opened in terms of the interest, not only from the players, but spectators. And so it was a long overdue, and it was a good event.
So tell us a little bit about the transition to coaching and about that experience.
I loved coaching. It was, you know, I got off the tour and I was like, I'm too young to not do anything, but what am I going to do? And I had a friend who was a cross-country running coach at McAllister College. And in some of my time off, I would go and talk to the team about the mental side of competing. And it made a big, big difference for them. And I just really loved the fact that I could share what I'd learned and help help them be better. And so when I got off the tour at McAllister, the men's coach was retiring. And all the coaches there knew me because I had been hanging around there for a while. And they said, "You should take this job. You should coach the men." And I was like, "I don't know, you know, here I am back at, you know, a woman in the men's game." And I went to one of their practices in the field, and it was in the spring, so in their field house, and they were about four guys, and they were hitting pitches across the field house, and they finished all the balls. And the old guy that was the coach was over there picking up the balls, you know, all, and the young guys were all sitting over there chit-chatting. And I'm like watching this. I'm like, "What?" And so I go over to the guys and I said, "Hey guys, you know," they knew I was there thinking about coaching them. Do you know what I hated about practicing by myself?" And they said, "What, coach, what?" You know, they wanted anything I could tell them. I hated picking up my golf balls after I hit them. And I look over at the coach, he's picking up the balls, and I said, I'll tell you what, if I'm your coach, that's not happening. Oh, you're right, coach. And off they ran, and they picked up all the balls. And I thought, you know, I think I could do this. But it was a lot of fun. It was there were things I didn't know that I wish I'd known better. But, you know, y'all always learn along the way. And after a year coaching the guys, then the school asked me to take the women's team as well. And I felt really good about what we did there. And it's more of an academic school. It's not an athletic school. So they're really there for their studies. And golf was something to do for them. But just to give them that experience. And, you know, we had everybody from some beginners, just so we could have enough on the team to, you know, low handicappers. But I took the teams from really being in the bottom of the barrel to being respectable, and I had some All-Americans, and you know, so it was a lot of fun. I did that for 12 years.
Yeah. Well, you've been honored with other accolades over your career. You were the first woman inducted into the St. Olaf's Athletic Hall of Fame. You were also inducted into the Wisconsin Golf Hall of Fame in 1995. And in 1996, you were awarded the Heather Farr Player Award. And for our listeners, just to who aren't familiar with that, that's given each year, really since 1994, by the LPGA Tour to an LPGA golfer who, through her hard work, dedication, and love of the game of golf, has demonstrated determination, perseverance, and spirit in fulfilling her goals as a player. That's quite an honor.
Thank you.
Yeah,
and that's probably coming off a pretty tough stretch for you.
That's right.
You know, losing your mother, and then the affliction you had to deal with, and then coming back and winning that major at Des Mauriers. So that was probably icing on the top for you, I would guess.
Well, it was, and you know, it wasn't something that I ever even thought about, and you know, it's just a credit to how I was raised.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, Martha, you know, before we let our each of our interviewed people go, we asked them all three questions.
Okay.
So, are you ready?
I hope so.
Okay. So, if I were to give you one mulligan, where would you take it?
Oh. Wow. A specific shot or a thing?
Well, let's give you one shot, huh? One shot.
Oh. Yeah, one shot.
Unless you got a really good thing you want to share with us too.
Yeah.
We take that.
Well,
too.
The one shot that I would do would be the putt on the 18th green at the Hershey tournament, where I could have gone into a playoff with Amy Alcott. I again didn't know until I stood on the 18th tee that I was tied for the lead. I saw on the 18th tee that I was tied for the lead. It got me excited. I hit it into a tree. I punched it out of the tree. I knocked it up on the green about 12 feet from the hole. And I knew that if I made the putt, I would be in a playoff with Amy, who had shot 65 that day or something, come out of nowhere to, you know, to take it. And my arms were so rubbery. I was shaking so hard that I literally, when I hit the putt, the butt of my club, my putter, hit my leg.
Oh, my.
And nobody knew that because the putt looked pretty decent, but if I hadn't known, I might have made that putt.
There you go.
All right, so Martha, the next one is, if you knew at age 20 what you know now, what would you have done differently?
I would have worked more on who I am, on my self-confidence, and being positive about what I was trying to accomplish, having better goals. I mean, we didn't have sports psychologists back then, but that's one of the reasons I got into coaching, is because I thought, if I had somebody at that age teaching me what I know now, I think I could have been a much better player or had a better career.
Fair enough.
So there's still one to come. You ready?
I'm ready.
How would you like to be remembered?
Somebody who gave their best. Just tried to be the best I could, and who did a pretty dang good job on the tour.
Well, you've done a good job with us today too, and we thank you for your time today, and you've contributed a lot to this wonderful game of golf. And again, we thank you for your time, Martha. It's been a joy having you with us today.
Well, again, I appreciate you guys doing this, not only for me, but all the other people that aren't necessarily the top of the headlines all the time. There's lots of great stories out there.
There sure are, and Martha, thanks for sharing yours.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.